Last week we were in the world of the Hasidim, and what characterizes that world is the individual, the downtrodden Jew, seemingly has no joy out of life, no time to really become a great Lamdan, and how the Rav can portray this Jew, the Shabbat Jew, the Yontif Jew, that the feeling, the emotion, the individual, the love for the Rebbe that is so close. And this comes across in the Rav's magnificent description of the Hasidic world, what he saw in Chaslavich, what he saw in Warsaw. Chaslavich is Lubavitch, Warsaw is Ger, Warsaw is Majids. But he recreates this world, the Vasatrega, the water carriers, the coolies, as he called them. And it's a magnificent description. But one thing I said last week, and Ashreni Shazarchinu Lekach, that my student Eli Babish was zeiche to add a footnote to the Rav. And here, I just want to spend a few minutes because it really is a golden find. And I don't know whether the Rav was aware of it or not, because what I'm talking about is on page 159, or 2.08, footnote 2, where the Rav talks about every Jew needs a Rebbe. And the problem with the Mitnagdim is that they are too critical, and as a result do not find one. And of course, I cited last week Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, I cited the Tenuat HaMussa, the Rav is citing Rabbi Yisrael here, and Rabbi Yisrael didn't say this exactly in this vein. Rabbi Yisrael said that everyone needs a Rebbe. The problem is the Mitnagdim think they, everyone can use a Rebbe. The problem is the Mitnagdim think they have a Rebbe, and the Hasidim think they have a Rebbe, the Mitnagdim think they don't need a Rebbe, and they're both wrong. And I said on the basis of Rabbi Yisrael's comment, this is probably the comment the Rebbe has made. What's amazing is Eli Babish showed me that the Rav didn't have to go far afield. He didn't have to go to Rabbi Yisrael Salanta. All he had to do was go to his own family. And Rav Chaim Volozhin makes exactly the comment the Rav made. And it's overwhelming. Here it is. It's Ruach Chaim, which is Rav Chaim Volozhin. This is the Rav's Elta Zeder, of course, the founder of the Volozhin Yeshiva, the Talmud Mufak of the Gaon of Vilna. The man who gives us Lithuanian Jewry, Reb Chaim Volozhin, where we would be without him. And Reb Chaim Volozhin, the Ruach HaChaim, on Pirkei Avot, Perek Aleph, Mishnah Vav, Rabbi Yeshua ben Pachya makes the following statement, Asei lecha rav, ukenei lecha chaver, vehevidon et kol chadam lekaf zchut. And the Ruach HaChaim infers the following obvious question. It's a non sequitur. Asei lecha rav, kenei lecha chaver, fine. What does it have to do with havidon et kol adam lekaf zchut? What is the interrelationship here? Asei lecha rav, kenei lecha chaver, fine. This is to learn Torah, to study Torah. Havidon et kol adam lekaf zchut is a different principle altogether. What does it have to do with the first two concepts? And Reb Chaim Volozhin says something fabulous. And I quote, Ki bilti zot lo tikein chaburutcha imo, ki yitered beinecha ki harava achava eina oisim kachagun, v'yupol meriva veinechem, l'chein emova havidon et kol adam lekap zchut. And that's exactly what the Rav said. We Litvakan are so critical, we're constantly finding fault. We're finding fault with our friends, we're finding fault with our Rebbeim. When you find fault with a Rebbe, he can't be your Rebbe anymore. A Chassid never finds fault. A Chassid will interpret everything the Rebbe does. Hubi Malamet Chavschud, the famous story, the Rebbe will be Machalu Shavis. And the Chassid will say, my Rebbe is so great that on one side it's raining, the other side it's raining, where the Rebbe walks it's dry, one side it's Shabbos, one side it's Shabbos, where the Rebbe walks it's Chol. That ad kedei kachu, the Rebbe will chasid be melamed zchut not a Rebbe. So Reb Chaim Volozhin says so beautifully, have you done the kol adam lekaf zchut? That's the only way you're going to have a chava, the only way you're going to have a Rebbe, because we're so critical, we're so quick to draw the gun, And I know what it means, the Litvish world. So it's a Litvish pshat, and that's exactly what the Rebbe said. We Litvakin will never have a Rebbe because we're just too critical. No one is good enough. However, the problem with the Medakim is that they are too critical, and as a result, do not find one. And I added a footnote to my the Rav. Compare Ruach HaChaim, Rav Chaim Volozhin. There it is. So you have now from Rav Chaim Volozhin to Rabbi Shlomo Salanta, to the Rav, to Aaron Rakefet, to Eli Babish. And this is what it's all about. So I have to say a big thank you and a big yakayach. Okay. Now, just to pause for one fleeting second. Uri, you asked me, I don't know if you realize the impact of your question, but one has nothing to do with the other. You asked me yesterday about Moshe Mendelssohn. That's a separate story altogether. Who is Moshe Mendelssohn? And why did he fail? And the question is a million times more difficult. If you've read Rav Moshe Mendelssohn's writings, where is he different? Rav Shmuel Shapol Hirsch. Rav Shmuel Shapol Hirsch we revere. And Moshe Mendelssohn, if you learned in Lakewood, they would say automatically, Moshe Mendelssohn, Yimach Shmo. When I learned in Lakewood, I thought his last name was Yimach Shmo. That's a fabulous question. But that has to do with the time. I can't go with now. Believe me, I have so much to say in this question. It's like piercing a balloon filled with water. The water is ready to flow. Shaftamai Misason. However, if you heard my eulogy in Jodometri, which you didn't hear, you heard a popular version, a haplap version given for now in West Hempstead. You have to hear the original tapes, which is Mamish, that's a Shia. But there I'm saying something else. In the year 2001, long after Mendelssohn left the ghetto, I personally am very hesitant to innovate because I've seen the results. When we start getting carried away with the isms that are so fashionable, we ultimately, at certain points, cross the boundary. And that's why I made the analogy of going from first to third. You understand, this was DiMaggio's greatness, that he was never thrown out. You all know in baseball, when someone hits a single to right field, so the runner on first has a better chance of getting to third because it's a much longer throw from right field than from left field to third. But you have to make a split-second decision, an instantaneous decision. You have to look behind you. You have to see what's going on in right field. And you have to decide whether to round the base. DiMaggio was never thrown out. And that was my analogy, that it's no chachma to try to go to third if you're going to be thrown out. The wind-up is you're not on second. It's only a chachma if you can make it to third. And that's why we have to go slowly. And this was the point I was trying to make, that I'm not against every generation has its right to be machadesh. And certainly with women, we've taken the women, we've come a long way since Sarah Shnira started teaching. I said a vod yesterday in Medreshet, that's an overwhelming vod. I gave a shiftin in Agudat Yisrael. So I said at the first Knesiyah Gedolah, Agudat Yisrael, they made two basic, 1923 Vienna, they adopted two basic principles that have tremendous impact on the future of Torah Jewry, one in particular. The first one was, they officially adopted Beis Yaakov. That Beis Yaakov, wherever they open a branch of Agudah, they open a branch of Beis Yaakov. That had a tremendous impact because until then Beis Yaakov was limited. The Belzer Rebbe gave his bracha. The Munkhacha maledicted them. Others stood from afar. Many put Sarah Shneer in Chayrim. What do you mean educating women? Who ever heard of such a thing? Women belong in the kitchen. Women belong in the bedroom raising children. Women belong in the playroom with the children. They don't belong in school. And when Agudat Yisrael took it under their wings, you understand the implications? The other decision was, of course, Reb Meir Lubliner, Reb Meir Shapira, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, proposed Daf Yomi. And they officially adopted Daf Yomi in 1923, finished us 7 years, earnest the same. So I said, imagine we've reached a point in life where I have Talmidot who is studying Daf Yomi. Did anyone ever dream of it when they said Beis Yaakov, they're going to teach Beis, and here, the year 2000, I have Talmidot who is studying Daf Yomi, but I'm a firm believer, the more women learns, the more she'll understand her role. Chas v'chalila, we're not here to change Torah, we have to surrender the Torah, and I'm in totally in favor of women's learning. I see it in my family, I see Ron Lichtenstein's family, I see the women learn, the Rav's family, knowledgeable, learned, and they know their role. There's no one more opposed to women's prayer groups than Atara Tversky, Rebbetzin Tversky, Dr. Atara Tversky. It says something. So that's my point of view. And that's Tansky al regalachat, but Hirsch has to be discussed within the context of 1760. And Eida and the women's Orthodox Women's Feminist Conference has to be discussed in the context of 2001. And what hurts me are blood libels. When you say Shalom Asani Isha is an anti-feminist blessing, that is literally a blood libel based upon ignorance of the source. It's so far from the truth, it's overwhelming. And that became today, women tell me off, women who are my devotees. I mean, women who say, if we ever had to consult the rabbi, you're the rabbi. And they and yet they're so brainwashed already. If in KJ, Kilat Jeshurun, the chazan doesn't say the bracha aloud, it's unbelievable the message it's giving. And once you knock away Shalom Asani Isha, believe me, Shalom Asani Goy, it's putting down Goyim. How can we put down Goyim? The universal world of friends of the UN, the world in which we live, barriers, Ribbono Shel Olam, why is that? Why Shalom Asani Eved? We don't have a Vadim, Rakefa gave Isha yesterday, by the time it's over, there'll be nothing left of Yiddishkeit. And this is frightening to me. Okay, but that's our regalachat. But I the depth of your question, it hit me yesterday that you were confusing two different periods to talk about Mendelssohn. Look, do you think we could have remained in the ghetto? Ultimately, sooner or later, close the door, please. Sooner or later, someone's going to go out of the ghetto. And here you have a tragedy. Whenever people leave, it's like taking a base Yaakov girl and putting her in Kalamazoo, Michigan. If you take a YU grad and put him in Kalamazoo, the chances are he'll remain a from Jew. You take a base Yaakov girl, the chances are she'll throw it all away. And when you come out of the ghetto, you're a Beis Yaakov girl. You're coming into a big world, and you can be blinded. And this was the tragedy. This was the tragedy of coming out. And Mendelssohn was the victim. But Mendelssohn himself was, who was Mendelssohn? He was named for his great-grandfather, Reb Moshe Isserles, the Ramah. Reb Moshe Mendelssohn is a great-grandson of the Ramah. And look into the Shilat Yavetz, there are, I think, two tshuvot, at least to Mendelssohn, by Reb Yaakov Emden. Look at the way he addresses him, but covered. Okay, it's enough for now. I don't want to go in. There's one incident where Mendelssohn argued with the rabbis, and I can explain it. I've given many lectures on the 72 hours. It's not hard for a YU person who studies science to understand. All right, and finally, the only other comment, the name is Rabbi Moshe Kripke. Write down the name so you know what I'm talking about. Your father will know exactly what. Okay. Now I'm ready to go further, and I've paid my homage to Eli Babbitt, and I have one more addendum tear to last week, and then I'm coming into the Lithuanian world. And this, my dear student Jack said to me after class, he said, you know, the fellas are going to walk out with a feeling that the Rav was philo chassid, totally pro chassidus. I mean, after all, with all that we've said, the Rav was farta litvak. I have to tell you, it's true. The Rav, with all his feeling for chassidus, but one time in the 50s in a Yotzeit Russia, and again, I state clearly, I told it to people over the weekend, their eyes open, I said the 50s was the Rav's decade, the 70s was the Lubavitcher Rebbe. In the 50s, the Rebbe was in his prime. The aggravation of the rabbinate, of establishing himself, of finding his niche in life were behind him. The aggravation of illness and death were yet to come. The Rebbe peaked in the 70s. He hit his apex. He hit the climax in the 70s. So in the 50s, in a Yahrzeit year, there were moments where the Rebbe, you know, put the text down, removed his glasses, and those were the most precious moments that certainly changed my eternity. And the one time the Rav was in the middle of a shia, and he suddenly says, "Eh, well, I'm stuck." And he says, again, I'll say it in English. I'll tell you, he says, if you have a machlokes with chassidim, he says, two ways you can push them against the wall, and they can't crawl out. And everyone's gone crazy. What's he about to say? He said, first of all, the obvious tefillah shelo bezman. Chassidim are not medayek in zmanei tefillah. It's very frightening. You go to the Kotel, you'll see people davening 11, 12 o'clock. You go to Zichron Moshe, you'll see fine Hasidic Jews davening 11, 12 o'clock in the morning. It's very frightening. And I live it. I have one grandson. I have, you know, children like adults. It's an inborn thing. Some people even more sleep than others. So one grandson, it's kriya chavsa for him to wake up early. Another grandson hasn't missed a minion since he's 11. He's up at the crack of dawn. This kid hasn't missed a minion, but the question is when. So he says to me, in all his innocence, Saba, how come at the Shtiblach, this is around the corner from where Jack lives, how come they minyanim at 9:30, at a quarter to 10, at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I see such Hasidic Jews, you know, from Jews going? How can you be opposed to it? Go and explain to a kid of 13 years old, these Hasidim are rotten, vicious, malicious, hideous, dangerous, deeply paid, degenerate, devout sinners of the highest order. You understand that they're davening Shalom Bizman? There's no way you can justify it. Now, a lot has been written. I can give you all the Hasidic justifications. It's all not worth the paper it's written on. It's pashut, a sin, period. And the Vilna Gaon was right. But now, 200 years later, it's become a chassid davens chabad, an unbelievable. Ger is more medayik in zman. Ger is a chassid that's built upon real lumdis. And they're more medayik with zman. Ger is the exception. But the regular chassid, you take the amshin of it. I mean, it reaches a point, I don't know what goes on today with the new Rebbe, with the previous Rebbe, he would make chavdalah Sunday morning. No, if you hold Shabbos till Sunday morning, you know, there's a day. Time is no factor. You can daven shachris at night, mincha in the morning, marv in the afternoon. We're above time already. The second issue, of course, was an issue that affected all of us, was eating in a sukkah on Shmini Atzeres. And this is an open gemara. The gemara in sukkah stuff memzayim la'ralav yetiv yatvinin mavarech lo mavarchim. And what the gemara is paskening is very simple. You have to sit in a sukkah, spake of the yoma. It's just like you would have an Achron Shal Pesach, you have an Achron Shal Sukkah. Shmini Atzeres has within it Chaloy Sheng, the right of Shmini Atzeres, and Chaloy Sheng, the Rabbanon of Achron Shal Sukkah. You don't have to be a big lamb to understand it. But because it's already Shmini Atzeres, and you're saying in davening, Yom Shmini, Chag Atzeret Hazeh, so the bracha would be a Tate to Satre, Leis Shev Basukkah. So Chazal say, bracha Deinim Akvat, so you yod say the mitzvah, which is Chiv, the Rabbanon, to sit in the Sukkah, and you don't make a bracha. And Chassidim, all of you know, and it was a big problem because we kids in the Bronx, how were we affected by it? I told you, for us to find the sukkah, we had a shtickle of Rebbe a few blocks away, Rabbi Ben Hillel, Rabbi Avram Ben Hillel, he was nice enough to let us use the sukkah when he finished eating, and he was a shtickle of Rebbe. He taught in Salanta, I knew from Salanta. So we ate Shmini Atzeres, he laughed at us. What do you need a sukkah for? Who needs a sukkah? You understand? You make kiddush in your shul sukkah. The minig was they used to make kiddush Shmini Atzeres morning in the sukkah. That was the end. And I possessed them from the sukkah. They left the sukkah and said goodbye. Said the Hiratzon. That's it. Over. Finished. Kiddush Yontif morning, but Friday night, Yontif night. Who needs a sukkah? Who needs a sukkah to eat? And it was a problem for us because we knew the Gemara. We were Talmid Chachamim in miniature. We knew an open Gemara. We were Talmidim of the Rav. And that was a problem. And the Rav said, on these two issues, the Hasidim came to win. Now, if someone asked me, so why Taka didn't the Hasidim sit in the Sukkah? I'll tell you, the answer is very simple. There's a whole sefer written by Rabbeinu Tzadok HaKohen, Tzidkat HaTzadik. But the gist of it is very simple. What happened in the Hasidic world? On Yontif, particularly Shmini Atzeres, there would always be a Fabrengen. The Hasidim came to the Rebbe. The sukkah was too small to hold the crowd. It fell under the category of Mitztaya. Added to that was a very simple Chishuv, a very simple Cheshbon. The whole purpose of Yontif is to bring Mekabel Panei Rabbo Beregel, to bring the students close to the Rebbe. That's more important than anything else. So they evidently felt that it was kedai to waive the chi of the Rabbanan of sitting in a sukkah to enable the Rebbe to reach out to the Hasidim b'menuchat hanefesh without tsar in the regular eating facilities, which obviously were infinitely larger than a sukkah. And that's how it began. And once it began, it became already a minhag. Hasidim don't eat in a sukkah. Hasidim shmini atzeres. Some make kiddush Friday night at night. Some don't make kiddush at night. Some just make by day. And it became a minhag unto itself. And the original reason was totally forgotten. And it became one of the major issues between Hasidim and mitnagdim. All right, thank God, Eretz Yisrael, we don't have the problem. And until recently, anyone who even observed the second day Yontif L'chumra, like Reb Moshe's Psak, but they never sat in a sukkah. Now, with the crazies, and with chumras on top of chumras, with looking, with Eretz Yisrael, Chas V'Chalil, it's not Eretz Yisrael, the whole approach, Eretz Yisrael is not a geographical concept, it's Golis yet, you have so many Jews, Machal Shabbos here, so many Goyim, so for the first time they told me, in hotels, people have requested taking the sukkah on Shmini Atzeres. They're visiting from Belgium, visiting from England, visiting from Borough Park, and the hotels think they're crazy, but the hotel will do what you want. The sukkah's standing anyway, so let them do what they want. But in Eretz Yisrael, it has no room at all. It's mamish an offensive concept, because if you know the Baal Tanya, understand, I don't want to go into more detail now, but if you're talking about the Baal Tanya in his first perek of the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, where he talks about the emanations from God changing from Kodesh to Chol, Kodesh to Chol, Chol to Kodesh, according to what the day is, it's offensive. Because here in Eretz Yisrael, the rays from God are rays of Chol, and you are sitting in a sukkah where you're trying to establish a certain kedusha which doesn't exist that day. Okay, but anyway, that's what the Rav said, and I never forget when the Rav said it. I was sitting there, you know, we were so happy, so excited. We'll always be able to defeat the Hasidim. There's no way they can justify themselves. The Rav said it. And later years, I have to tell you, I studied all of Tzidkar HaTzadik. I saw that Rabbeinu Tzadik HaKohen. I gave so many lectures on Chassidut. I analyzed the problem from every point of view. When all is said and done, the Chassidim try to justify it, but the justification can be shut down halachically. Emotionally, you can find justification. Even the Tefillah Shelo Bizman, they say Rabbeinu Fishimul, call at smont night Tamana Hashem. You can't daven kol. All your bones are ready. It takes time to wake up. Others say Chassidim Rishonim, the Mishnah in Brachat Hayashem Shah Achat Mimit Palalim. We have to wait a little longer. That would be good if you woke up at 6 o'clock in the morning and sat around learning and studying, going to mikveh, preparing yourself. But to wake up at 9 o'clock and go to mikveh at 10 o'clock and have a bishul bramfin to daven with a pshtikul lekach at 10:30, and then at 11 o'clock to start davening, what does that have to do with chassidim rishonim hayashom shachat? Okay. So I have to tell you, while the Rav had great feeling for Chassidus, when he wanted to put the needle in, these were the two needles he used. Yes, story. Oh, excuse me? Okay. Now, let's come to Lithuania. And here I just want to give a drop of introduction. It's very fascinating. This is the Rav's world, and it's the Lithuanian world, and it overtakes us. Now, number one, what characterizes the Lithuanian world more than anything else is the study of Torah. This is the mitzvah, the most important mitzvah, the highest goal, the most enveloping goal. This is how we reach, and it's the exact opposite of the Hasidic world. Davening and kavana and esoteric thought and shom sha'achat, everything is minimized, everything is dwarfed by the study of Torah. That's number one. As a result of the study of Torah, you have another tremendous difference from the literature to the Hasidic world. And this difference is so powerful and so true. The Hasidic world is all-encompassing. It can involve millions. The Litvish world ultimately boils down to the rare individuals that measure up. See, there's a tremendous difference here. Let me say it very simply, as I've said it before. I think my example, I have it an Aaron Rakefet copyrighted example that's very powerful. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, at one Farbrengen in the 70s or 80s, spoke to more Hasidim than the Rav taught students in all the years, 44 years, that he taught in Yeshivas Reb Zichrochan. You don't have to say it any sharper than that. One Farbrengen. I was in 770 this summer. I saw it on, I told you, Saturday night. I celebrated Yud Tet Kislev by watching a video of the sixth Rebbe. Fabulous, fabulous material. And at the end, they showed the seventh Rebbe talking about the sixth Rebbe at a Farbrengen in 1983. All right, there was the room I was in. That's the room I remember. There were at least 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 people outside of the Lubavitcher. You don't know what used to go on. Loudspeakers, the whole street, Eastern Parkway. Police were all over the place. It was blocked off for most of Eastern Parkway. Cars could only get through in one lane, if that much. It was a sight. It was a sight. It was an experience. It was a chavaya. And then closed circuit before the satellites, closed circuit TV, then satellites all over the world. Ribbono shel Olam. One Farbrengen, the Rebbe spoke to more people than the Rav taught in his classroom in 44 years of teaching. Not only that, everyone who heard the Rebbe, you'd say, "Who are you? I'm a Chassid." 99% of the people there. There were a few sightseers, a rakefet, let's say. If I went to a Fabrengen, I would call myself a sightseer. It became a minig. Anyone from Israel, from the consul, anyone who was visiting, all right, he was a sightseer. I don't say that everyone became a chassid. But 99%, 98% were chassidim. You talk about the Rav had 5,000 talmidim, perhaps, in 44 years. How many were talmidim? I can still meet guys who say, yeah, I sat in the class, you learned, the guys in front learned, we sat in back. By the 70s, when they were over 100, 110, 120, I walked into the Rav Shi in 1983, it was a sad sight. There were like 140 guys sitting there, maybe 20 guys in front of the Rav who actually knew what was going on, could hear him, could bear with him, because Nebuchadnezzar, he was already very slow, it was a sad sight to see. The Rav, who I recall in his prime, and the Rav in his very, very last years, his waning years. And the rest of the guys, they went out with girls. They boasted, yes, I'm in Rabbi Soloveitchik's class. The girl should have given him a vechena. The girl should have said, what do you know? She would have found out he takes oxygen away from Rabbi Soloveitchik. Nothing more. And that's the difference. You see, polling, you talk, I said the millions. How many Litvish yeshiva fellas do you have? How many hold by learning? And this is why the stress will always be on the Yechidei Skula. Then there's a third factor. And this is a factor that carries over, we'll see it today as well. See, in the Hasidic world, as much as the Rebbe was above the people, saintly, but the Rebbe was available to the people. Part of being a Rebbe is you must designate times when anyone and everybody can see you. You talk about Ger, I think there are 3 afternoons a week where the Rebbe is makabel kol. Anyone here a Gerah? Where you go in, people are waiting. I once had to bring Rabban Soloveitchik into the Gerah Rebbe, so we had arranged to come in through the back with the wheelchair. When Rabban would come, they would not keep him waiting. In other words, but I saw the sight. Hundreds of people are waiting. And the Gabbai becomes very important in the Hasidic world, because the Gabbai opens the door, lets you in. He's a man of power. And the Rebbe must make himself available. This is a sine qua non requirement. The Chassid needs the Rebbe. He has to see the Rebbe. He has to speak with the Rebbe. Lubavitch, in the early years, every Chassid could have Yechidus with the Rebbe. Do you know when? On his birthday. Chassid on his birthday told the Gabbai there was Yechidus. The Rebbe kept unbelievable hours. They gave you a time, 12 midnight, 1 after 12, 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning. The Rebbe kept unbelievable hours. But every Chassid could see the Rebbe. Later on, when Lubavitch became so big, and I mentioned this to you, it reached the point that Rebbe already stopped being Masada Kedush and stopped having Yechidus. And then Lubavitch came up with that unbelievable idea of the Rebbe giving out dalabas. When you think, I mean, it's just mind-boggling how they would go into the all these dollars. Have you seen that? Brand new. This was delivered direct from Washington. Millions of dollars in $1 bills. Brand new, crisp, unused dollars. First time put into circulation. The Rebbe never ran out of dollars. Think of the preparation. Now here I want to show one movie next week. So we went, Aaron, we explored, we saw the amphitheater, we checked it out. I hope Aaron will remind him this week, check that the equipment is there. I want everything to go right. On one little movie to show one video. Imagine what goes on. Who knows how many are going to come? But Sunday morning, what used to go on at Chabad, do you remember the lines? People, and for that split second that you saw the Rebbe, a split second, you said a word to the Rebbe, you told the Rebbe, you asked the Rebbe, a bracha, people, their whole lives were changed by that split second. That's a Hasidic world, you understand? It's overwhelming. The Rebbe had eyes, penetrating, piercing eyes when he looked at you. Right? And the Hasidim believed he looked at you. He knew everything going on. He knew what was in your mind. He knew what your request was. The Hasidic, he really believed it. I don't know. I'm not a Hasid. It's hard for me to say this is true. But that's the reality that they had. And even the Lubavitcher with 50,000 Hasidim had to make himself available. And a man in his late 80s standing all Sunday. He was standing. He never sat. And everyone walking by. And oh, what? Well, what a Rebbe, and what a relationship. This is Hasidus. The Litvish world, the Rosh Yeshiva, is distant. There's already an aura between him and the students. There's not so simple to approach. He's the Gadol Hadar. He's the London. Yirat Shemayim et Hashem Elokecha Tira et L'rabot Talmidei Chachamim. Here already, what Pirkavis talks about, the Neshit, the Neshicha, the bite, the sting. Heavy Zahir, be careful the way you speak. The Hakpada. I mean, Ad Kedei Kach, those of you that read the memoir literature, the Netziv got angry at a student, he smacked his face. We're talking about the Netziv from Volozhin. Could you picture a Rebbe smacking a Chassid? Couldn't happen. And the Netziv from Volozhin wasn't any backwater fanatic. You're talking about the Netziv, you're talking about one of the great precursors of the Zionist movement. You're talking about the Netziv who fought. You read the Meshiv Dava, Mem Dalit Chelek Aleph, his famous trivia against separatism, what we spoke about yesterday. The Netziv came out very strongly against Rav Hirsch, 100% against Rav Hirsch. When I was a kid and the Rav came out against the other Rosh Yeshiva, refused to issue an Issur on the synagogue council and the board of rabbis. So I thought, gee, the Rav is revolutionary. I can't believe he stands against Reb Aaron Cutler, stands against this constant Reb Moshe Feinstein, stands against Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, stands against this one, that one. And then later in life, when I started to learn a little, you know what I say, Yeshiva, when you graduate and you get smicha, smicha's a license to start learning. Until then, you're learning what your teachers want, what your rabbin wants. You have to pass exams, you have to cram. What do you know when you get smicha? What do you know? Let's be honest. What did I know when I got smicha? But after you get smicha, smicha only gives you the capability to learn an alphabet. That's what smicha is about. That Baruch Hashem, this young man worked many years, and he now knows how to put together rabbinic language. And now you start learning. That's what life is about. So I remember when I learned the Meshiv Dava, I couldn't believe it. I said, wow, the Rav was Bechadish nothing. This is his great-grandfather. This is family tradition from Reb Heschel Leib. I don't know if Reb Chaim agreed. I don't know if the Beis HaLevi agreed. But Ribbono Shel Olam, this is his Elder Zeta, black and white. The Rav was Bechadish nothing. And here the Netziv was capable, and read the memoir literature, read the volume on the development of the yeshivat in Lithuania by Shol Stamfers, doctorate of Hebrew. You, it's a masterpiece. The Netziv smacked the student, and I gave a resounding smack. Students went out and striked. The Netziv had to apologize. But that very attitude couldn't exist in a Hasidic world. We walked into the Rav Shir, Yitz will tell you, we were frightened. Maybe he came from Boston, he wasn't so frightened, but he'll tell you, the 50s, we didn't walk in there with smiles on our face, we walked in there, this is the Shir, this is the Rav, this is Matan Torah, this is Reb Chaim's grandson. If we say something foolish, he's going to chop our heads off. When a chassid goes to Lubavitch of Abrengen, I can still recall the joy, the happiness, as the Rav describes, they're coming closer to Ger, their smiles on their face, the shkina rutzacha from panim. What a difference between a Lubavitcher and between a Talmud of the Rav. It's overwhelming. This is just overwhelming. It's magnificent when you think about it, but it's two different worlds, and it reflects. Now, the Volozhin Yeshiva. So let me reiterate three different points that will come up. One, Torah study is the be it all. It's not miracles, it's not Hasidic stories, it's not something davening, moving heaven. Here you're moving heaven and earth, Torah study. Two, by definition, it cannot be a mass movement. A mass movement can be Hasidus, can be a Fabrengen, can be a Hasidic song, can be a Shlomo Kalbach. The literature world, Yechidei Skula, by definition. And that continues until today. Number three, in the Hasidic world, the Rebbe must be gracious. There are very few exceptions. The Kutzke, there are exceptions to what I'm saying, but very few. The Rebbe must be gracious. The Rebbe must be available. The students have to be able, the Hasidim have to be able to approach the Rebbe. This is a Fabrengen. He must be there. He has to be makabel kahal. He has to be, that's what a Rebbe is all about. The Gerer Rebbe, I believe it's 3 afternoons a week. You can check it out with Gerer Hasidim. Where any chassid can come, you take a number, you wait online, the gabbai calls you in, the Rebbe is ready, the Rebbe sits for 4 or 5 hours, lakabel panei chassidim, lahadrich, lanot, to give advice, to answer. Even in Lubavitch, where it reached the point the Rebbe could not talk to individuals, so they came up with the giving of the dollars, and that was the whole idea, that you had that fleeting moment where the chassid's eyes and the Rebbe's eyes meshed into one. Yes, Aye.
You think that's true?
So Aye is raising one of the points I don't want to get involved with. Aye, you read my mind. You're a Hasidic Rebbe. I didn't want to get involved. See, that's on the Israeli scene right now. It's one of the major points. When you talk in terms, look, they now want the 40,000 yeshiva boys with an exemption. That exemption originally began with 300 fellas at the time of Ben-Gurion. After all of European Jewry was destroyed, there was nothing in America yet. What did America have? 1948, 49, they pleaded with Ben-Gurion, don't interfere with these 300 fellas, Toratam Umanatam, let them learn. They're our future. Today you have under 40,000. It's impossible there's so many guys learning. It's impossible there's so many bright minds. It's impossible so many guys can master Shas and Pais, can restrain them, Achrayin, and Psak Halacha. It's impossible. And this is one of the real complaints today, that it's become a way of life that if you're Haredi, you don't serve in the army, period. The so-called yeshiva boy deferment is only a cover for the fact that your lifestyle or your lack of ability to deal with the outside world doesn't allow you to serve in the army. And it's one of the big problems today. And you're absolutely right. The fact that there are so many yeshiva boys today doesn't necessarily mean that they're learning and they're great. It simply means that the yeshiva is a way to escape the realities of life out there. Okay, is it good? Is it bad? Obviously, it's a on the Israeli scene. I, for one, you cannot go on having this division bein dam ledam. It totally eats away at Israeli society. It's a real problem. Barak found the peg on which to hang his hat, but the problem is real. The problem is tangible. On the other hand, you can't force a solution. It has to be worked out equitably. It has to be worked out over the years. The Neman Commission, not bad what they came up with. When a person turns 24, he can go into the army, do less service, go to work. He can leave the yeshiva. Ultimately, we'll have Haredi units in the army you already have. Little by little, we'll find a solution. Halavai. But there has to be goodwill from both sides. What we have now is a cause of tremendous tension. I've told you more than once, this is why Torah suffers so much in Israel. There's no tshuva in the Ashkenazic world. Because the Ashkenazic world, they see this cleavage and it pushes them to the other side. The Sephardic world never lost it. And in the Sephardic world, everyone serves in the army, basically. There's a lot less draft exemption. So in the Sephardic world, they have a massive tshuva movement. The Ashkenazic world, the few Bali tshuva, you can count on the fingers of your hands, all wind up in Breslov. And an Ashkenazi, Tel Aviv, Schenken person who winds up in Breslov, this is a sign of extremism. It can affect individuals, but you can't have a massive tshuva movement because they're not going to go to Breslov. And the draft factor is the main factor why we can't get off the floor, because the minute you try to teach and preach and lead and set an example, they say to you, but why don't your boys serve in the army? But I agree with you. The fact that there are 40,000 yeshiva boys doesn't mean there are 40,000 chassidim. It means 40,000 people adopting a certain lifestyle because they can't handle the big world beyond. And this takes us back to education. Something was taught to me in 1971 when I was new to Israel. The elder girls in Mechala who used to meet with me once a week and clue me, you know, what's really happening in Israel. So they said to me, the problem with the Haredi world is that their education does not prepare the student for an encounter outside the ghetto. And that's my example of the Beis Yaakov girl in Kalamazoo, Michigan. What will remain of her? And this is a problem, Haredi chinuch. On the other hand, when you mechanech too openly, they'll wind up like Aaron Rakefet for the Haredi world. That's a tragedy, you understand? So they have a problem. They have to be able to solve it. They recognize it's a problem because they're losing a very substantial, it's not a road, but there's a mir hanikar of Haredi kids who leave the Haredi phone. They recognize it's a problem. They're Haredi kids not only in America, in Israel too, drug pushers, Haredi kids involved in prostitution and sex. It's a problem. They recognize it. But how to overcome it without upsetting the basic apple cart is a challenge to them, and so far they've only been able to overcome it on the periphery. They have certain schools for kids who have problems, drug problems, kids who have been in trouble with the law, the Haredi Nachal now. It's on the periphery. It's not yet a massive solution. Okay, 301. This, of course, is the most famous story of all. Rav Heschel Schechter talks about it, the Rav talks about it, Shel Shtampfer. I give you a lot of sources, and this is a fact. In Volozhin, the voice of Torah never ceased. They learned around the clock. They always saw to it that there was someone in the Beis Medrash. They had Mishmarot. The middle of the night, there were students learning, so that there was never a moment when the voice of Torah was not heard. Even the Rav describes at the Zman of Mincha Shabbos, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu died, that's why we say Tzidkat Tzedek. My grandsons just asked me the other day, why? Ma pitom omim Tzidkat Tzedek b'zman Mincha? And it's Taluy in Tachnun, why do you have to say something sad, Mincha time, when you say Tachnun, you say it, don't say Tachnun, you don't? Moshe Rabbeinu died, Minik Yisrael is that we don't study Torah Shva Peh, we're unveiled for Moshe Rabbeinu then. And even then, in Volozhin, one student was studying Choshen Mishpat, when everyone else was studying Medrash, easier matters, and this student went on to become a gong in Choshen Mishpat. What's fascinating is the last paragraph, and here I want to expand. What does the Rav say? That even Motzoi Yom Kippur, now remember Motzoi Yom Kippur, you have been fasting. It's a moment of tension. People are anxious to break the fast. It's a 25-hour fast. It's a difficult fast. And even then, all the yeshiva boys ran to eat. They're younger, they're hungry. And there's the Netziv in the Beit Medrash, sitting and learning, not breaking his fast, until the first fellas come back to pick up the learning in the Beit Medrash. The Netziv, v'chvodo v'yatzmo, sitting in the Beis Medrash, could you picture the sight? Yom Kippur is over, the stars are out, Havdalah has been made, the masses are running to eat, and there's the Netziv, doesn't leave his shtenda, he's waiting another hour. When the first fellows will come back, the Beis Medrash should have the voice of Torah. Okay. I want to put into context here, I hope I'm a mensch. If I'm a mensch, it goes back to one story in my life that had an indelible impression upon me. When I learned in Lakewood, I was in Lakewood Rosh Hashanah. Why you began, I came back, whatever the story was. And Yom Kippur, we made a special minyan in the yeshiva. It was in a building that's no longer standing. The library building, which today is the big library, former museum. These were small little buildings built right after World War II on that block with government funds, pre-constructed buildings, Bernard Rebel Graduate School, the library, a science hall. And in one of these buildings, we had our own minyan, and at the minyan was the yeshivish minyan with real davening, without balabatim, with yeshiva boys, with Rashi Yeshiva, and the minyan was won by the mashgiach of the yeshiva, Rav Yaakov Moshe HaKohen Lesson. The great Rav Lesson. Rabbi Konan, Rabbi Reuben and I were both Talmidim of the Mashgiach. Little did we dream we'd be sitting in Yerushalayim 50 years later, but we were both Talmudim of the Mashgiach. His presence is in the room now. So one Yom Kippur, the Mashgiach got up before Ne'ila. I'll never forget this. And he said a Shmuas, and the gist of it was, don't look at your watches. Don't be in a rush. You know the way people are, every Chazan, you ever see a Chazan daven Ne'ila, there's a watch right next to his marza. Chas v'chalila, he should be more than 30 seconds late. You understand? I was in the rabbinate. I know what I'm talking about. Your brother-in-law davened for me. Chaim was chazan in Maplewood 1 year. And I stood next to him, guiding him with the watch, how much piyut to say during the ilah. We had to cut some of it out because chas v'chalila, I would go overtime with balabatim in Maplewood, New Jersey. So the Mashgiach is giving the Shmuas, what is Yom Kippur? It's a day of nitzchiyut, netzach. You become like an angel. You don't eat, you don't drink, that you don't wash, you don't have sex. You don't wear leather shoes, like an angel. Yachafim, like an angel. He says, don't run away from nitzchiyut. Don't think about food. Don't look at the clock. Make ne'ilah the most meaningful tefillah. And as he finishes speaking, one of the Rosh Yeshiva, Reb Shmuel Eliezer HaKohen Volk, my Rebbe I stood with 2 years before the Rav, HaGaon Adir, HaTelzer, Rav Volk jumps up and starts screaming and shouting, the Mashgiach hat nicht kein Seichel, ist da Freuen und Kinder und kein Menschen und mit Fast und mit Essen and how can you talk about keeping Yom Kippur longer and Rav Volk shouts and screams. And I remember the Mashgiach sat down, he, you know, Yom Kippur, embarrassed him, yelled at him, smacked his face in public, Yom Kippur before Ne'ilah. I didn't see that again until at the Kotel, 1969 was the next time I saw it. Right before Neil, a chassid got up to daven, and a chassid from a different side, and I wasn't smart enough then to know what the sex were, but evidently one was a rabaril and one was this, got up and maledicted him in front of everyone, a sheik, it's his rebbe who sheik, the man, and this Yom Kippur before Neil, embarrassing, you want to embarrass someone, do it on a Monday morning, December 18th, but the Bani Shalalim of Kippurat Neil. About 3 months later, I'm sitting in the Beis Medrash, and the Mashgiach comes over to me, I have to talk with you about something, could you come outside? I had made a shirach. It was an interesting story. The Mashgiach came into the yeshiva about a year before that, and he said to me, you know, this person davens at the minyan in the yeshiva, he's a balabas, he has a daughter, just graduated Beis Yaakov, she wants a yeshiva boyfriend, the yeshiva. And I recommended one of the boys, Reese. Remember, there's a fellow there, Reese. I recommended Reese. P.S. Within 3 months they were engaged, 6 months they were married, they've lived happily ever after. So Mashgiach says to me, I have to make a shit if I have. Except for two people, Yaakov Meir Lansky and Effi Tchelet. Baruch Hashem. Mordechai Kaplan remains Mordechai Kaplan, but I just want to practice the new names, Ari Stechla. I should know who's here. Where is Moshe Shoket? Shaket? Shochet? Tabach? Where is he? The Taniel is keeping him up already? Effi and the I wanted to be Mordechai Kaplan, so the world should know there's one Mordechai Kaplan and there's another Mordechai Kaplan. And one brings us covet, and the name is wonderful. It's just what you do with it is what counts. So the Mashgiach comes over to me, and he has this girl, and he's talking, and you have to know the Mashgiach is not Rabbi Blau. Rabbi Blau is one of the boys, he's one of us. We're now talking to Mashgiach with Slabodka, with a Bekisha, with a famous split beard, although Rabbi Blau's beard is not exactly an outstanding example of a thick beard, too. My dear friend Jerry, forgive me. We were Chavrita, Jerry and I grew up together. But this was the Mashgiach, Slabodka, Talmud of the Alta. And his hands, remember, he used to rub his hands, and he's the woman, and his shirich, and the whole world hinges on the shirich. And who is the woman? Who is the girl? Rav Volk's daughter. And I walked away. I can't believe it. 3 months earlier, Rav Volk embarrassed him in public. And today, the Mashgiach's whole goal in life is a shirich for his daughter. At that moment, I said, I will never, ever forget this lesson. This is Musa. This is greatness. This is the gadlut of the human being, gadlut Adam. Never be petty. Never take revenge. Be gracious and be big. And that's Yom Kippur. And that's the Nitziv. Could you imagine the Nitziv? There he was. I don't know if the Mashiach told us about it that time. I remember hearing it from the Rav. But that's an example. Yom Kippur is over. Everyone's running to eat. Chas v'chalila, the voice of Torah should not be lost. 302. Ah, this is the height of Lithuania. Stories within stories. Number one, I personally had a lot of aggravation with this 302. Why? I didn't hear the story direct, but Joey Epstein was in this year. He told me the story. David DeRoven was in this year. He confirmed the story. And they both told me, contact Chaim Ilson. He was in this year, and he has everything in perfect notes. Chaim, Rabbi Ilson happens to have been my student. He's the only student, he's Makar Tova, the only student I ever kicked out of my class. The only student. It's a true story. I went to Mr. Abrams and I said, Mr. Abrams, Ilson is too good for the class. I'm holding him back. He's two shirim above the rest of the kids in the class. And Abrams said to me, but he's the best student you have. I said, yeah, but I'm not fair to him. Push him up two classes. Mr. Abrams saw him giving up the best kid in the class, pushed him up two classes. I think from my class he was pushed up two classes. I think from there he went to the Rav. That's how brilliant Chaim Ilson was. He's the Rav's top Talmud out of the 70s. Mamish. What he can do with a Daf Gemara is more than Rabbi Lichtenstein or Rabbi Shoshechta. That's his specialty. He can emulate the Rav and Brisk to a T. Understand? Rabbi Aaron is not that way. Rabbi Heschel is not that way. Each one has a different specialty. But he is the Rav to in that area of Brisk. So I call Chaim, and Chaim goes to the, he has it all on the computer. He gave me everything. He gave me all the facts. He built the everything. I then write it up. You know, I write it up. And my minig was, if someone gave me information, I sent them a copy, how it's written up. I write it, Joey edited. I worked and we worked back and forth. Joey and I have a very close relationship. It was a beautiful way to turn this book out and polish it as best we could. Turn out this work. So I then send it to David DeRoven. Beautiful. Send it to Chaim Ilson. I get no answer. Now, it's very awkward. Joey knows it's my Talmud. Joey's my Talmud. Joey, I say to Joey, do me a favor, see what's bothering Chaim. Joey says, I'm going to go Chaim Ilson. Bunk into him in Hanof and see what's bothering him. Joey bunks into him, and Chaim is, oh, what Rabbi Rakefet did. It was terrible. What was terrible? Tell the story here of a meeting between Rabbi Chaim Volozhin and his Talmud Mufak, Rabbi Yaakov Shik, or Rabbi Yaakov Kalina Rav, the Mishkan Ot Yaakov. It's a Meridik story. It's a Litvish story. This is pure Lithuania before your eyes. Rav Chaim Volozhin basically never met privately with students. There was a distance between him and his students. He said his shir, he was the Gadol Hadar, you gave respect. This was the Litvish yeshiva world. Rabbi Yaakov Kalliner, Agon Adir, the Kalliner Rav, Rabbi Yaakov Shik, once a year would come to visit his Rebbe. And Reb Chaim would be makabel him b'yichitet. And the Rebbe and his Talmud would talk. So right away, you see Lithuania. Number two, look what Lithuanian Talmidim were like. It's the Gemara in Brachot. Remember, Rav, someone hid under his bed. Remember Rav Kahana? A Rebbe's having relations with his wife and his Talmud is hiding under the bed. Gedenkst or not? And the Rebbe knew right away, says, is that you? He knew which Talmud could be so arrogant. And he says, Torah, I have Torah, even the Modern Yitzhak, what can I do? I have to learn everything from the Rebbe. Ribbono shel Olam. Not everything I have to learn from a Rebbe. Got a little bit of common sense. No, ad kedei kach. Ad kedei kach. It's a merit to Gemara. I want to tell you, it's a merit to Gemara. So the Talmidim, two of the Valashian wise guys, they wanted to know what's going on. What is the Talmud and the Rebbe talking about? They hid on the roof. And they heard the conversation. And then the conversation begins. Imagine hiding on the roof. There's a skylight. These are like spies. This is Mamish with Rachav on the roof with the skylight, hiding. What are you? And they hear, Reb Chaim asked, Reb Yaakov, how are you? How's your wife? How's the family, the children? Rebbe, how are you? Your wife? And then they began to talk and learning. And you can read the whole story. Reb Chaim asked him a tremendous question. What's the question? What's the answer? He can't give an answer. He starts to cry. Reb Chaim says, you see, you feel arrogant because the Rebbe meets with you privately, but I know you're going to find the answer. And he finds the answer. And I showed this, so it's a miracle, so it's a literature story, Talmud Torah, the Rebbe, the Talmud, the arrogance, the distance, it's an unbelievable story. What's the matter with what I wrote? Chaim says, what do you mean? Look what the Rebbe wrote. For a few minutes, the Rebbe and disciple engaged in small talk and caught up on what had been happening in their personal lives. Then Reb Chaim said, I have a difficult question that perhaps you can answer to get the Gemara Svachim. They wasted a few minutes asking how their families are. Beetle Torah. Who would waste time like that? And that's what he challenged me. So I went to Tova Lichtenstein. I showed her my version. I told her about Chaim Nilsson's version, and Tova knows Chaim Nilsson well. And Tova said to me, you keep your version in. What does Chaim think? That they were barbarians? Of course they, what are you, not? You meet someone you haven't seen for a year, you don't ask how your wife is, how the children are, leave it in. Remain in. Look at the last paragraph. The last paragraph is the heart of a lashon, the heart of Gris, the heart of the Rav. So the Rav tells the story, Reb Chaim gave the answer. The Rav broke into his characteristic smile and exclaimed, how do I know that this is a true story? This always haunted the Rav. We said this before. How do we know it's not a Hasidic story? How do I know it's true? Hasidic stories, Hasidic to Meislach. What are these? Litvish and Meislach. How do I know it's true? Because the son of one of the Vloshina students who hid on the roof told the story to my father. My father related the details to me. I know the exact Tosvat. I know the question, I know the answer. Look what has happened here. This is Torah Shabbal Peh. This is tradition. This is the heart of Torah. In this little paragraph, look what the Rav has stated to us. Think for a minute. Remember we spoke about this in the terms of the Vilna Gaon and the Chazan, the old Chazan, the Vilna Gaon walking, the secretary of the Beit Nun Chaslavich. Think what you've just heard. That the Rav's father spoke to a student who hid on the roof when Reb Chaim Volozhin spoke with Reb Yaakov Kalina. So it means Reb Chaim Volozhin, Yaakov Kalina, to the Talmud, to Reb Moshe, to the Rav, to David DeRoven, Chaim Nilsson, and Joey Epstein, Aaron Rakefet, to Ira Eben, and Aaron Levitt. This is what it's all about. And this is the heart of Torah, this is the heart of Litta, this is the heart of our learning, the heart of our tradition, and this is where we're different than conservative Judaism, halachic conservative Judaism, whatever name you want to call it. The living, ongoing tradition. One beautiful little paragraph. 303. What a story. What a footnote. And what inferences. This part of the story can land us in jail in the present day state of Israel. Pshuto kemashma'o. And the Rav tells the following story. Heard it on tape, word by word, recorded here. Magnificent story. All of you know that the Russian government was very heavily involved in trying to Russify the Jewish people. I related to it yesterday. Russia constantly had a problem that there were so many minorities in Russia, there was no one who was an indigenous Russian. And in order for the Tsar to survive, in order for Russia to survive, they've tried to Russify the population. So regardless of your ethnic or racial origin, you would feel that you are a Russian. One of the biggest problems was the Jews. the Jews dressed differently, acted differently, lived differently, spoke differently. Their whole frame of reference was to a different world. And how do you crucify them? And time and again, they did what they could, limited the Jews, where they could live, what they could do, where they had to go, what type of schooling, how they could dress. And time and again, Gedolei Yisrael would meet with the leaders of the Tsarist government, shtatlanut and bribes, and try to avoid or avert the evil decree. And here the Rav tells a story, the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, Reb Menachem Mendel, and Reb Yitzchak Volozhin, the famous Volozhin of Rosh Yeshiva, constantly were meeting with the Tsar's representatives. They were the two leading spokesmen for the Jewish people. One was the Gadol Hadar in the Litvish world, Reb Yitzel, the son of Reb Chaim, the father of the Netziv, and one was the Gadol Hadar in the Hasidic world, Reb Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Tzemach Tzedek, Agon Sheba Ga'inim, heads and shoulders above all the other Rebbeim at that time. And it's a Meredith story. The Tzemach Tzedek, as they leave the Tzars, as they leave his peoples, the ministers, so the Tzemach Tzedek turns to Reb Yitzchak and he says, I can read your mind, I can tell you exactly what was on your mind right now. And Reb Yitzchak looks at him, what's going on here? Suddenly, you're starting... wait, it's the opposite. The Reb Yitzchak says to the Tzemach Tzedek, I can read your mind. I can tell exactly what you're thinking right now. And the Tzemach Tzedek turns around and he says, what's going on here? They started practicing Moifsin Voloshin. You've become Hasidic Rebbeim. Litvish Rosh Yeshiva, become Hasidic Rebbeim. And Reb Yitzchak says, no, we haven't. It's not a Moifis, but I can still read your mind. I'll tell you exactly what you're thinking. You're thinking that Nicholas, the Tsar, his representatives, are the prototype of Amalek. And the Tzemach Tzedek says, you're absolutely right, that's what I was thinking. And here you come to the Rav's famous Divrei Torah B'Shem Aviv, what is Amalek? And the Rav said over in the name of his father, the name of Reb Chaim, time and again, and it's this story as well, Amalek is not a genealogical reality. It's a lifestyle. People that want to destroy the Jews have a status of Amalek. Period. It's not limited to a race. It's limited to a movement in ideology. And b'chol davadar kamim aleinu, and they have a din of Amalek. The Rav says it even clearer. That's my footnote. Kol Dodi Dofeik. The Rav, when he published the Kol Dodi Dofeik, published a long footnote where he claims that the Arabs are Amalek. Pshuto kamashma'o. Hitler was Amalek, the Nazis were Amalek, the Arabs were Amalek. When people's goal is to wipe out Jews, they have a halachic status of Amalek with all the implications. Now, from this little episode, two derivatives. Number one, do you see how hard it is to classify the Rav? Everyone speaks of the Rav as a dove. Michael Melchior has told people, I am the continuation of Rabbi Soloveitchik in this generation. Michael. Why he wanted a Melchior? The kid, never. I can't get mad at him. I get mad at his rebellion. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein got up this past summer and he spoke of the Rav's viewpoint of giving back and for the sake of peace and the Kotel and Yerushalayim in public. People walked out, but Rabbi Aaron said what he said. Walking out doesn't accomplish anything. You have the Jewish point of view. Said it in public. And quoted the Rav. I just quoted the Rav to you. It's in print. Look at my footnote. You'll find it. Black and white. Who is the real Rav? He didn't say it. He said it many times. This was Davar Yadua, Amalek, the Nazis, Germany. He raised the issue. What's the chalosh shame of the communists? Could be during Stalin that it didn't have Amalek too. But certainly during Brezhnev it may have changed. That's certainly during Khrushchev's time there is a change. You have to admit it. Although it's not as much as a change we would like, but the change begins with Khrushchev. And we have it in volume 2 where the Rebbe deals with it halachically. But this, so that's one inference. Very powerful. What was the Rebbe's point of view? Very difficult to classify him. He had hawkishness, he had dovishness. There were different periods in his life. He thought each individual, each situation out. But a statement like this is absolutely hawkish to the second power. Other story that comes with this that only I can tell you. Bididi Habayuv, that happened to me. You all know that I have a tremendous commitment to educating Russian Jews. My feeling is if we don't educate them, you can put a lock on the state of Israel as a Jewish state. So, Baruch Hashem, I'm indirectly responsible for thousands of Russian Jews that have beards and payas and dress in black today. And I'm proud of it. So, one of the things I did years ago, I raised funds to translate some of the Rav's writings into Russian. So we did the Hachshuv in Russia, we did the Conspectus in Russian, and we did the Chamesh Drasha in Russian. And this was done at a time that the communist empire, it has to be about 84, 85, the communist empire is in full swing. And you should know the translator came to me and said, Rav Rakefet, if we published this footnote with this concept, whoever is caught with this volume will be thrown to Siberia. Because the implication is that the communists have a din of Amalek. And we made a decision to leave it out. It's the only part of the translation of all the work I'm responsible for in Shvut Ami where we altered a thought of the Rav by leaving it out because Pikuach Nefesh applied here. Ad Kidei Kach was this powerful. Okay. Now we come to the high point of today's shiur. And I hope I can finish by the end. But this is crucial. Important. Indescribable. Gentlemen, as a kid already, I found out that in Volozhin they were opposed to Musa. The 19th century Lithuania gave birth to two tremendous ideas. One idea, Volozhin, a focal central yeshiva. Aaron, what am I saying? What went on in Volozhin? Am I saying people didn't learn Torah? Chas v'chalil, everyone learned Torah. But you learned in a haphazard, desolatory fashion. You went into the base medrash in your community. The rabbi, very local community, was the Raven, the Reish Matifta. That was his title, Av Beitin, the Reish Matifta. Not every rabbi knew how to teach. Teaching is an art. Knowledge alone does not guarantee that you will be a good teacher. Being a good teacher without knowledge is bad, and being a great knowledgeable person without the ability to teach is equally inconsequential. And those are the facts of life. All of you have had teachers, all of you have been exposed to knowledgeable people, and all of you know people can have that ability, you can't have that ability. And Rav Chaim Volozhin made a decision in 1802, 1803, it's time to organize a structured yeshiva, not leave it to chance. Why? Why was this decision made at that time? What do you say, Yaakov Meir? Because the world was changing, and the winds of enlightenment were sweeping over gradually from Western Europe. And Rav Chaim Volozhin understood very well that if those winds sweep over, they're going to bring change. And it's not like the old system. The old system of Eitan went into a base medrash, and at Jägerland and at Nishkelerand, and Joshua, yes and no. They remained from Jews willy-nilly. Bal kacham, val apam v'chamatam. You didn't change. Everyone was from, everyone's Shomer Shabbos. By 1800, if you didn't succeed in learning and the system didn't succeed and the winds are blowing, you can become a maskil, you can become a chalal Shabbos chas v'chalila. And Reb Chaim saw already, now we need a focal yeshiva. We can't leave it to chance. And every Ben Torah should read Reb Chaim's letter where he calls for the establishment of Volozhin. Do you have access to it? It's published in Mostar HaTorah by Mirsky. You can find it. It's quoted, requoted. Every volume has to deal with it. But most of the Torah, you'll find the original letter. Reb Chaim says, we're going to have the best teachers from all over Europe here. And we're going to have the best students. There are going to be gradations. There are going to be classes. It's going to be a whole new system. Organized, what you take for granted. You all went to Yeshivas with Rochanan. You had classes, you had grades, you had gradations, you had exams, you had teachers. A teacher who wasn't good didn't stay. They only, I hope, the yeshiva have to be knowledgeable and a certain basic teaching ability. All right, not everyone can teach on a high level. Some teach better, some teach less, but at least basic ability. And Voloshin was going to be a focal central yeshiva. That was one idea. A second idea that was born in Lithuania in the 19th century was the idea of the great Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the Musa movement. What is the background of the Musa movement? Very simple. Rabbi Yisrael saw, already his Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Zindel saw, because to be more correct, the founder of the Musa movement is Rabbi Yosef Zindel of Salon. Rabbi Yisrael is the popularizer. But they saw what went on in Europe, what goes on among people, what goes on in Borough Park, what goes on in Mei Sharim, what goes on in Kibbutz Adati. When people are from, we're from, our parents are from, our grandparents are from, we're from, our children are from, many of us wind up doing most of it out of habit. The words of the prophet, Mitzvot Anashim Mulumada, this is the nature of the beast. You put on tefillin this morning, you daven this morning, you'll daven mincha, you'll daven marav. Did you ever think for a moment what you're doing? Dalef ne'miyatom me'ed, in a yeshiva we try our best, you're going balabatim daven. And it, of course, many things we do, rote, habit, like a monkey train, mitzvot anashim melumada. Now Rabbi Yisrael Salanter reached exactly the same conclusion of Reb Chaim on a different level. Mitzvot Anashim Mulumada is a human malady. There's no way you're going to get rid of it. Human malaise. You're not going to be able to get rid of it. This is the nature of the beast. We eat here. Aaron has, what does he have here? What do you have in front of you? What do you have here? You're here. He has a madan, a vanilla treat, 3% fat. What do you eat? He's not going to think. He's not going to be bunny. How lucky he is. The Israeli industry, the food, it's so wonderful. It's so good. The dairy products, the vegetable. We eat. Finish. Fatik. We don't make cheshbonos. We don't think. Most of what we do in life, we get into a car, we switch the car on, we drive away, we're listening to the radio. Mitzvah, we stop for a red light. It's habit. That's the way a human being lives. A human being is a creature of habit. The only time we pause to think of chas v'chalila, we were sick and we couldn't eat and now we start eating again. Oh, how much we appreciate it. If chas v'chalila, we're in battle and we were saved and we come back and the first time we say birchat ha'goymol, oh, how much we appreciate it. But that's the nature of the beast. Until the 19th century, it didn't matter. A Jew remained from, remained shom, Shabbos, with mitzvot, and with kavanah, without kavanah, the Jew remained good and decent. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter saw, and I'll say Rabbi Yisrael simply because he was the popularizer, that in the new generation there has to be a different answer. People have to be kept from. The winds of change are blowing. Haskalah has come to Eastern Europe. Russification is battling in Eastern Europe. At all angles and levels, they're trying to break down the walls of Torah. Hasidus is for Poland. Eastern Europe can't utilize Hasidus. It's a popular movement, Famei Haaretz, who clings to a Rebbe. We need something more intellectual for Lithuania, White Russia, for the Litvisha, Misnagdisha world. And he developed Musa. And all of Musa was, think what you do. Pause before you act. Think what you're getting into. He developed the concept of the Musa Klois. Go away from the Beis Medrash, go away from the shul, go away from the roar of the crowd, go into a room and concentrate, think, who are you, what are you? Mayayim Batlan Atahulech, if you recall, the Musa Klois was a room without windows. It had no distraction, only Musa tomes, a melancholy, depressed atmosphere. Pull yourself together. Yom HaNarayim, they went, they came to Rabbi Yisrael, they came to the big Musniks of the generation. People stayed in the cloys, learning endless hours, and make it meaningful resolution, davening, pause and think, and kavanah, and shma, and religious acts. And it should become a lot more than a trained monkey or mitzvot anashim mulumata. two great ideas of the 19th century, born in Lithuania. And now Rabbi Yisrael Salanter raises three great Talmidim, the London among them, a Gaon Yisrael, Rabbi Yitzchak Blazer. Rabbi Yitzchak Blazer, the pre-Yitzchak, a Gaon Adir. Had two other great Talmidim, Rabbi Simcha Zissel, Rabbi Naftali Amsterdam, but the Gaon Adir, Rabbi Yitzchak Blazer. Rabbi Yitzchak Blazer comes to Volozhin and he tries to convince the great Volozhin of Rosh Yeshiva, tries to convince Rabbi Chaim, you must institute Musa in Volozhin. And Rabbi Chaim, in popular language, throws him out head first. In halakhic language, Rabbi Yitzchak quotes the Gemara in Brachot Reb Chaim. I cite it all here in the text. Li'olim yagiz adam yetzer tov al yetzer ra. And if that doesn't help, ultimately, yizkilo yom hamita, frighten the yetzer hara, beat the hell out of the yetzer hara, remind him of shrouds, remind him of a coffin, remind him of man put into the earth. And Reb Chaim responds, in Pagabacha Menuvul Zeh, Moshu Leveit HaMedrash. Quotes a different Gemara, Gemara in Sukkah. If you meet that Menuvul, you meet the Yetzirah, bring him into study Torah. Don't get me involved in Musa. Don't get me involved with a Musa Klois. Don't get me involved with the Yom HaMita. Don't get me involved with your whole attitude, your whole approach. There's only one way to survive in this world. Study Torah. Of course, as a kid, I was overwhelmed. What did Reb Chaim have against Musa? The Rav used to sit in when Rav Lesson came in to give a Musa Shmuas once every term. Remember, the Rav sat right there like one of the students listening to Rav Yaakov Moshe HaKohen Lesson give a Musa Shmuas. What went on here? What troubled Volozhin? What I quote from here, of course, I consider the most unbelievable, insightful, important part of the Ish Halacha. I think Rebbe reached unbelievable heights with his analysis of what Reb Chaim had against Musa. And there are two points that the Rebbe stresses. Point number one, and it's all here in outline form because you have to go much deeper than what the Rav actually wrote in Ish Halacha, but I heard the Rav discussed with the Rav, and I know it was built upon this, and I'm just analyzing what the Rav said, but it's the Rav, it's not me. Number one, two tremendous points the Rav makes. Number one, look, let's take a simple example. I walk into class, and you stand up for me. And I tell you not to stand up for me. And I tell you I'm still a kid in MTA. Let's try to analyze what just happened. Did I really mean that? Maybe I'm showing false modesty. Maybe I'm not so modest. Maybe I want you to stand up for me. Maybe I want to cover. But I'm just trying to show false modesty so I should be more popular with my students. Starting to analyze. Let's take another example. We drive out of Gris Kollel and two Machon Lev boys stop and ask me for a lift. And they thank me. I say, shum daba, it's nothing. Hey, wait a minute. It is something. What are you saying? You gave them a lift, you opened your car, you let them in, you paid more for the gas, more weight on the car, more gas, or whatever it is. No, you're saying shum davar because you want them to say, see that fellow who came in Aliyah from America, he's a nice guy. Gentlemen, we have a basic principle. When a Kohen finishes the avoda, you're off with the Gemara, he's allowed to wear the Bigdei Kohuna back to the Ta, back to the locker room. And the Gemara gives a reason why. Lamrot that we say lo nitna Torah lehenot, lo nitna bignei kahuna lehenot, you're not allowed to have it. You're not allowed to wear it when you're doing the avoda. But lo nitna Torah lemalchei hasharet. What do you want? The kohanim should strip naked in the middle of the Beis Hamikdash? So the Gemara says clearly they're allowed to walk back to the meltecha, to the dressing room, and change their clothes like a mensch. My dear students, the Rebbe is saying something magnificent here. A Jew is not obligated to pull his mind apart psychologically. Lo nitna Torah lemalachei hasharet. We act in a certain fashion. We act humble, we act decent, we act nice because the Torah commands us. We don't have to start making the psychological cheshbonot. One of the reasons that Reb Chaim objected to the Musa movement is that it got involved in too much self-analysis and introspection. To put it in our language, Musa put you on the Freudian couch. And a Jew is not obligated, and it may even be harmful. And this is one of the real problems of those of you that are psychologists, you will understand what I'm saying. Sometimes, better not to analyze, better not to introspect, not enough to take yourself apart, because you will not know how to put yourself together. I've had two students that had to be institutionalized because of graduate school work in psychology. Both of them Holocaust survivors, and on the couch, they were studying. This is Firkoff. I taught her brother later, one of the girls, I taught her brother right here in the Griscoll. He cried to me, why you let his daughter go to graduate school in psychology, knowing her Holocaust background. I said, what do you want? Why you? When a woman of 21, 22 wants to go to graduate, why you stop her? But they took themselves apart, didn't know how to put themselves back together. This goes with all the outreach programs. When you talk about NCSY, you talk about outreach, one of the most important factors you have to know before you attack someone's world, someone's values, are you going to be able to help them to restructure a new, normal, healthy world in place of the one that you destroyed previously? And if you don't know how to do it, you may be better off not attacking them at all and not reaching out at all, because better to be not religious and normal than to be semi-religious and totally crazy. And we've all seen this in outreach and tshuva, and it's a very difficult problem. And the Rebbe hit the nail on the head. There was too much introspection, that whole lo nitna Torah lemalachei hasharet. I don't have to start analyzing why I told you not to stand up for me. Maybe I'm really doing because I'm an arrogant guy, not because I'm a humble person. I don't have to start out why I said shum davar to these guys. Maybe I really said it because I'm an arrogant guy, not a humble person. It's a decent human. I want to be decent. I have to analyze. Don't have to put myself to couch. Don't have to take myself apart. Don't have to Freud do a job on me. That's one. Two. And this is unbelievable. Only the Rav. I hold this to be the height of the Rav in philosophy. I've never seen this equal. What he said is in each halacha. It's overwhelming. Overwhelming, the man's mind. Then too, the Rav said something else. Look, there's universal religion and there's the unique expression of our religion, the halachic man. For the sake of what I want to say now, the unique expression of halachic Judaism. Many times we differ with universal Judaism, universal religion. Now, what does universal religion mean? Have you studied comparative religion? A good deal of universal religion rests and builds on the fear of death. Have you ever heard a Catholic priest on a Sunday morning? Have you ever read Dante's Inferno? In what's it called? The Inferno of Dante? If I have the Dante, what's it called? Dante's Inferno. Have you ever read it? Punish Allah. Every punishment, how many angels are going to beat you? You ever hear a priest get up on a Sunday morning, rant and rave against sin and passion and carnal desire, and ultimately death will come? And you ever hear a Protestant fundamentalist who will rot in the dust, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, earth to earth, scare the hell out of you? No, you come to Torah. Rav Hirsch's comment, the famous comment, Emol El HaKohanim, Dabei El HaKohanim, what's the halacha? When there's death, a Kohen cannot enter the room. The symbol of religion, the Kohen, death, that's when religion goes out the door. Torah Chaim, living religion, dignity of life, the joy of life, the sanctification of life, the sanctification of carnal desire. That's Torah. That's Torah. Totally different than universal religion. Ah, only the Rav could reach these heights. Look at the Musa movement. What was the Musa movement? What did I tell you before? You didn't pick it up. You went to a Musa Cloy's, no windows, melancholy, moribund atmosphere, no big lights, little candles, the Cloy's. What type of svarim did you study? Death, fear, Musa, hold off, Yom Narayim, Pachad, Eimat Hadin. Look at some of the original Musa svarim, Eimat Hadin. The Rav said, Rav Chaim Volozhin, my forebears intuitively recoiled, C-O-I-L, from universal tactics. This was not Judaism. Relax, I'm going to answer your question in a second. This was not Torah. This was universal tactics. And that's why they wanted no part of the Gemara that says, Yaskilo Yom Hamita. They wanted the Gemara, Mashchul Levet HaMedrash, and tossed Rav Yitzchak Plaza out. It's Meredek. But then the Rav says, and I'm paraphrasing what I quote, Ish Halacha, and these are the Rav's words, when the Musa movement matured in the next generation, the Alta from Slabodka, Rav Natan Zvi Finkel, the Talmud of Rav Simcha Zissel, when the Musa movement matured and it put on the garb of Gadlut Hadam, the whole thrust changed. Slabodka, no fear of death. This wasn't Shiflat Hadam. This wasn't Rav Yoshel of Nevadik. Remember in the third generation, aren't you? I'm talking about the big split. Nevadik versus Slabodka, Gadlut Adam versus Shiflat Adam, Reb Yisrael Horowitz Shiflat Nevadik, Reb Natan Zvi Finkel Gadlut Slabodka. When Musa matured under Reb Natan Zvi Finkel, under his Talmud, Reb Yeruchim Levavitz, the Miriam Ashkiach, when the thrust became the greatness of man, no longer death. You ever hear a Musa Shmuz? You ever deal with a Slabodka? Eitan Holza, look at that beautiful shirt he is wearing. Look at that magnificent laptop, whatever you call it, he's working with. Look how capable this individual can be. Look at his fingers type out a tune, a song, a Shir Mizmor LeDavid. Look how beautifully he does it. Oh, Gadlut Adam, Eitan, as you type out and act in such a dignified fashion, this human greatness must color your standing before God, your actions before God. You are the Bechir Kapav, you are the Bechir of the Yetzira, you are the chosen of the creation. Vatasheu miyat mi Elohim, you are slightly less than an angel. Bring dignity to your position, to your status, to your tradition, to your upbringing, to your forebears. Gadlut Adam. And then the Rav said, in later generations when it matured, my family no longer felt alienated by the Musa movement. And I had on the postscript, and that's why Yitz and I was zeicha to sit before the Rav when the Mashkiach came in, and the Rav sat there like a chad mei haltamid. I remember once the Rav said privately, after zeyu gut gezakt, he loved, you know, Rav Lessen had a deep insight, and the Rav, wonderful, wonderful what he said, and we were zeicha. Now I have to tell you, on this topic, why there was opposition to the Musa movement, the Rav was the first to publish on this topic. the psychological aspect and the way he dealt with the death in the universal religion has been quoted and widely quoted. In addition, Sri Deha Esh, Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg, in volume 4, has a very prominent essay on the Muslim movement and why there was opposition. And he gives about three more reasons in addition to what the Rav says. He actually doesn't deal with the Rav. He gives four reasons there. One is the Rav, and one is he says the same thing that the Rav says here. As far as the psychological analysis, he doesn't deal with universal religion. The whole philosophical thrust is not there. He gives other reasons. And later, Reb Dov Katz, in the classic work, Tnuat HaMusa, the first five volumes are the history of the Muslim movement. You cannot be a Ben Torah. You cannot have a heart that beats with a Torah beat unless you know these five volumes by heart, beginning with Rabbi Yosef Zilman, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, and the three Talmidim I mentioned today, and the next generation, Rabbi Simchel Zissel, and the Alt of Slabotka, and Rabbi Yisrael Horowitz, and it's magnificent. And then, after the five volumes appeared, evidently Rav Dov Katz got a lot of feedback. He was a Rav, he was a secretary of the Beit Din in Petach Tikva. He was a very, his son, is Rav Yoshua Katz, as a Rosh Yeshiva in HaKotel. That's the son of Rav Dov Katz. I believe his son-in-law, if I'm not mistaken, that time, I may be wrong. I think there's a time with Chaim Gold as well. No, I'm positive there's a time there. And right, he ties in. Reb Dov Katz was the son-in-law of Reb Chaim, of Reb Zev Gold. I believe that's the tie. And it has to be checked. Reb Yoshua Katz and Chaim Gold are first cousins, or first cousins once removed. I'm telling you, there's a tie. They're first cousins there. There's a tie. So he had to be, Reb Dov Katz had to be a son-in-law of Reb Zev Gold. I think that's the way it works. So when these five volumes appeared, people said, what about the opposition? Everything is beautiful, everything is good, everything is rosy, everything is magnificent, five volumes. What about the opposition? And then the last volume Reb Dov Katz published before his death was a sixth volume, which is Ole Al Kulam Pul Musa Musa, the fight around Musa. And there he has great citations and analysis of what the Rav said, what the Chiel Yaakov said. He goes further, analyzes it, brings the facts, the details. It is the most fascinating volume you could ever want to pick up. So you see, if I may paraphrase the Gemara, everything the Torah prohibited, they found the heter. You understand the blood, you can eat a certain, you eat, well, what does the Gemara say? You eat liver, you get the taste of blood, this and that. There's always a substitute. If you ever have a Yetzer Hara for great machloiget and lashon hara and rechilit and infighting and backbiting and face slapping, read Pul Musa Musa and you will get it all out of you. My dear students, to reiterate, okay, that's meiridik, that piece. But wow, what we have yet to come, I wouldn't miss the shiur on January 29th for all the rice in China and all the gold in Fort Knox and all the money that AR is getting. How come I have the same initials as that ball player, Aaron Rakefid, AR, he makes $25 million a year, and I don't know if I got $25 for this year, but I'm certainly not complaining. My dear students, to reiterate, what did we do today? We, in honor of Eli Babish, we added a footnote to one of the stories we spoke about, one of the insights we spoke about last week, the Ruach Chaim from Reb Chaim Voloshin. It's meritic. I wonder whether the Rav knew that. He evidently had to see it. He didn't go through his great-grandfather, but it didn't register. You understand what I'm saying? Because he quoted Reb Yisrael Salanter, and I had to turn over my head and plume my ear to try to show Reb Yisrael didn't say exactly what the Rav said, but you can infer it. And here, exactly what the Rav said is by his Elter Zayda of Chaim Voloshin. And I thank you, Eli. Fabulous. That's number one. Number two, Ellie's right here. Number two, constant Torah study, what Voloshin was, Yom Kippur, next year in Gris Kolel, who will volunteer to keep on studying when everyone is going to eat?